You're listening First Time Dads.
With me, Richard Innes.
And me, Steve Meyer. When you become a parent, it's all about decisions. But you have information thrown at you from all different directions, and it's all about how to make the right decision.
Fortunately, Emily Oster, who is a professor of economics at Brown University, has written a book called Crib Sheet, which is a data-driven guide to better, more relaxed parenting. Basically, she's gone through various studies and all sorts of numbers to find out what's good advice, what is the bad advice, and which ones to listen to.
We caught up with Emily down the line from her home near Boston for this week's podcast. Enjoy. Emily, thanks very much for joining Rich and I.
Thank you for having me.
So you are currently in Boston, is that right?
I'm in Providence, so it's close to Boston, but we're about an hour outside in Rhode Island, smallest state.
I'm going to come across as such a Luddite here, but the fact that it sounds like you're sitting here next to us in the studio still blows my mind, I must admit, given you're on the other side of the Atlantic.
It's pretty amazing, I agree.
Am I right in thinking Providence is like an island that you access by boat from Boston?
No, it's just on the highway. If you're driving from Boston to New York, you drive past Providence.
Okay. You had me sold there, Steve, when you said you sounded so convincing.
I've been to Boston, and I was pretty sure that I went on a boat to somewhere called Providence.
That's Provincetown.
Provincetown.
It's on the end of the Cape. Actually, you can also drive out there, but you can take a boat there, but that is not Providence.
I'm not entirely lost my mind through lack of sleep as a parent then. I was sort of a bit on the right track.
You were a bit right. You had a rough right.
I like the fact that people come to this podcast for parenting advice and we're now giving them travel stories as well, inadvertently. This is marvellous.
Different places you can go on the eastern seaboard in America.
Indeed. So you're a mum as well as being an academic and an author, right?
Yes, that's right. I have two kids. My daughter is 8 and my son is 4.
It's a game changer, isn't it, being a parent?
It is a game changer. It really, it's always sort of hard to describe to people like quite how much it changes. I knew that I was going to have to be doing things with them and there was going to be time with the kids. I think the thing I didn't recognize before I had kids was that I would spend so much of my time thinking about them, even when I was trying to do something. Like my job.
Indeed. and your book, if you could just explain the background to how you came to write it, Crib Sheet, that would be really useful.
Yeah, so I wrote when I was pregnant with my daughter, and then when she was little, I wrote an earlier book called Expecting Better, which is about pregnancy and was really about like using data to make decisions in pregnancy. And then I eventually decided to follow that up with this book, which is called Crib Sheet, which is really about kind of what does the data say around a lot of the parenting decisions that we struggle with. And so things like what is really the evidence on breastfeeding or on vaccinations or, you know, where should your baby sleep or with older kids, discipline or potty training, and kind of trying to dig in to the evidence and separate out the better data from the worst data and give parents something on which to base their decisions and maybe a little bit of a framework for kind of how to incorporate that data into making decisions that work for them.
That's incredible, because the thing that struck me when I first encountered the book was, why has nobody done this before? Because I think you talk in great detail in the introduction to the book about the kind of insanity of parenting advice, and this is something Steve and I have talked about on the podcast so many times in so many on so many different subjects. The fact that the parenting advice is just hysterical. It's everywhere, and you're encountering it on Facebook, you're encountering it in the media, you're encountering it everywhere, and there's so much contradictory advice, etc., etc. So it seems so obvious that somebody who has, you know, the qualifications that you do, knows how to work with data, would just go in and find some numbers, because that's all I've been looking for a lot of the time. I just want to know a scientific fact rather than someone's opinion.
Yeah.
Give us an example, Emily, of one of the things that you looked at. So let's take, for instance, I'm right in the middle of baby sleep hell.
Right.
And you mentioned there just a moment ago about where your baby should sleep. How did you look at that as a subject within the framework of the data?
Yeah, so the big question here is, you know, what is the, like, should your baby sleep in your bed and is that dangerous? So in the US in particular, there's a tremendous amount of emphasis on not having your baby sleep in your bed. And there's a lot of kind of discussion of how it's, like, super dangerous to have the baby sleep in your bed and that's, like, you know, you absolutely should not do that under any circumstances. But of course, on the flip side, a lot of babies actually sleep much better with their parents. And also there are people who will tell you, like, oh, that's the only way to stay attached to your baby, like, I can't believe you're not sleeping with them, don't you love them, you know? And so you really do, that's a place where you really get both sides of this and both sides feel really strongly. And so what I do in the book is I just say, okay, let me, like, actually look at what the evidence says and look through all of the academic papers and try to look at not only, you know, is it risky, but how risky. So really trying to help people understand the size of these risks, not just are they there. And so what you find when you do that is that, you know, one very important thing to say is that if you're going to sleep in the bed with your baby, it really matters how you do it. So you shouldn't, you know, drink or smoke cigarettes or have a lot of covers in the bed. All of those things are really make sleeping with your baby much more dangerous. If you do it in, like, the safest way possible, there is still some small risk. But the size of the risk is, it's pretty small. It's, like, you know, comparable to the risk of a car accident. And so on the one hand, it kind of says, you know, yes, it's right to say that there is some risk associated with this behavior, but it's not right to say that risk is the most risky thing you could ever possibly do. You are probably taking risks of that magnitude every day. And so, you know, I think that what that means is as a parent, you kind of have to think about what are the benefits for you. And for some families, like, sleeping with your kids in your bed is, like, a thing that they really want to do. And I can see, given what the data actually says, I can see that being a reasonable choice.
See, I think that's really, really interesting what you said about risk there, because I appreciate we're talking specifically about the baby in the bed situation. But I imagine that can be applied to pretty much all the other subjects you cover, because the thing that strikes me with a lot of parenting advice, there's going to be risk attached to anything, right? I mean, there's a risk attached to crossing the road with your child, but you're still going to learn to, you're still going to be crossing the road with your child. And that's where I found it very, very difficult when looking up advice on certain issues, that there's this idea that, yes, that's not good. Well, why is it not good? How much of a risk is there? And I think that's the problem, is often we get that idea, it is risky. But as you said, you need to quantify the size of that risk, right? And do you find that has been the case with many of the different subjects you've looked at?
Yeah, I think that comes up in a huge number of these things, sort of how big are the risks, how big are the benefits. Mm. I think there can be this kind of, on the benefit side as well, there's this general sense of, like, if anything is even a tiny bit good for the baby or even a tiny bit risky, you should either always do it if it's beneficial or never do it if it's risky. And without recognizing, like, first of all, you have to do some things. And also, you know, you, like, kind of, it, the these things may be, the benefits may be so tiny or the risk may be so tiny that you got to put it in the context of the other stuff that's going on. That's why I like, sometimes I like to use this sort of car, the car driving car accident example as, like, a sort of way to benchmark risk, because I think that's a risk that most people are taking all the time and never thinking about it. And then, you know, they're thinking, like, oh, I would never, like, use a bumper on my crib. That's, like, these things, I don't know what you call them, like, where you wrap around the size of the crib,
yeah,
so the baby
thing.
Can't
bumper.
Okay, bumper. So, like, in the US, people are like, bumpers are the most dangerous thing you could ever conceivably have. It's like, well, maybe there's a little bit of risk, but it's tiny relative to these other things, and you need to kind of think about these risks in some context.
Is there an element of, I mean, we're human beings, right? And we are able to cherry pick the bits of life and justify them to ourselves that make our life the way we want it to be. So, for instance, Rich and I both know that we could probably do with losing a few pounds. But
speak for yourself, Steve.
We're still going to buy ourselves a chocolate bar, and we'll offset that with going, well, you know, I walked up the stairs a couple of times today. Mm. That's offset that. And is it a bit the same with parenting, where we think to ourselves, well, you know, I know there's probably a risk for the baby to sleep in the bed with me, but I really want to sleep, and I'm prepared to take that risk in order to get some sleep.
So I actually think if people said that, I think that would be fine. I mean, I think that's like the rational way to make the choice. I think what I think people actually do, which is not so good, is to say, well, I've decided I'm going to sleep in the bed with the baby, and then I'm going to convince myself that there's actually no risk to it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go and tell other people, like, you know, you're like, there's no risk to this. Like, you're making it, you know, you should absolutely make this choice because this is the best choice. It's the choice I'm making. So I think we are like, we're sort of backwards engineering into saying this is the choice that I'm making, and therefore it must be the right choice. And then telling other people my choice is so right that it has to be the choice you make, which I think is not so helpful.
That seems symptomatic of society as a whole, doesn't it? Just to get a bit broader than parenting. It's that sort of rush to the extreme. Like, this is my ideological stance, and I'm sticking to it, and it is 100% right, and you are 100% wrong. And we seem to have lost that kind of grey blurriness in the middle. And I think I'd never really thought about it in the context of parenting, but actually I can see what you said there. That does really apply to parenting advice generally, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, I think it does. I think there's really a sense in this and many other spaces in your life where, like, once you've made a choice, you just kind of like want to go all in on it. Not recognize that other people are going to make, you know, different choices.
I've had this thing at home recently, in fact, in the last few days with my son. So my wife and I, we don't really watch much TV at home. And the kids are lucky enough to live in a house where there's a playroom that is separate from the lounge and doesn't have a TV in it, so they don't watch TV. And it was never a conscious decision for them to not to watch TV. We just don't really watch much TV as a family, and so therefore my son's now got to just over 3 and he hasn't really watched any TV. I mean, he's watched it at other people's houses when we've been to like a barbecue and there's been some TV on, but that's happened only once or twice. And I think maybe at his nursery they maybe put on a film once and he's watched that, and he certainly watched some football or soccer, as we call it here, you know, like 10 minutes or so with me. And there was some cricket on last night and he watched 5 minutes of that. But I got invited this weekend to go to a screening of the new Lion King film and take my son.
Nice.
Now, he would love that. It would blow his mind. But I spoke to my wife and she's like, yeah, but he doesn't really watch films. So why are we taking him to that? But apart from the chance the opportunity's there. And we've actually gone, well, yeah, okay, well, let's just not take him and let's keep it in reserve, and he will get as much pleasure from it further down the line as he's going to get from it now. But I don't really quite understand in my head why we're not doing it, apart from we've not done it up to this point.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think it's worth I think it's worth saying, like, what do you think would be it sounds like you think the benefit of this would be that, you know, he would enjoy it. But I think the question is, what's the cost? Is the cost that then he would want to watch it every day, right? And then I mean I think that is a real cost, because then at least to a second question was like, what are your rules going to be? Are you just going to say, you know, this is a one-time thing, we never watch TV again? Is it going to be like, are you going to start having a little bit of TV? And I mean, I don't know. I think people come down like a little differently on TV in particular. My kids do watch some TV, although not very much. Other people here, like many people's kids, watch a ton of TV.
Yeah.
I should cut in at this point and say my son watches way too much TV. And I suppose a differing view to Steve. He watches too much. I wish he'd watch a bit less. But we've got ourselves, we kind of did that thing where we kind of got ourselves into a routine without really realizing we were doing it, and now we're kind of stuck to it. So we kind of went too far down that path. We thought, yeah, watch a bit of TV, fine. And I sometimes waver back. I'd be really interested to know what your research has found on this, Emily, because I waver back and forth where on some days I think, my God, why am I watching Toy Story again? And why is he watching Toy Story again? And is this bad? But then there's other times when he's sitting on my lap and we're watching something together and we're talking about it, and I'm thinking, well, 10 minutes ago he was having a tantrum, we're now sitting here talking nicely to one another, and that's because of the TV. And I know there's that idea that your TV should not be your parent, which I entirely, you know, agree with. But there are times when I think, well, actually, the benefit, to your point about benefit and cost, well, maybe the benefit here is that where I would have been stressed and he would have been stressed and we would have been shouting at each other, toddler and father shouting at one another, which tends to happen quite a lot. Now we're both calm and okay, as long as I can kind of extricate him from it without him having to watch an hour of the bloody thing, then we move forward. So I day by day I go back and forth with myself.
You're still gatekeeper, sure. Ryan. You're still the gatekeeper to what he watches.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
not
absolutely.
Like he's got a screen yeah. with access to the internet.
No, God, no. And I never leave him on his own. And I never leave him on his own. You know, because I'm really aware of that. The idea of the TV being the parent. You know, I don't believe in the idea that you plonk him down on the sofa and walk off and do something else. It's always. We're always watching it together and kind of engaging with whatever it is. But what did you do much research in this area? Amanda?
Yeah, so I looked a little. I both sort of TV and then at screens more generally. And I think that the evidence on TV is better than the evidence on sort of screens like apps and stuff. But still, it's still not great. I mean, I think the basic problem is when you compare, you know, kids who watch a lot of TV to kids who don't. And here we're talking about a lot, like, you know, 3 hours a day or something. You know, that those kids are different in other ways, so it's hard to learn from those comparisons. But I think the better evidence on this, which uses, like, for example, evidence from the introduction of television, so like the time when we first started allowing first started to exist. I think that evidence is reassuring in the sense that it suggests that probably TV doesn't really seem to have like negative impacts on things like test scores for kids. Although, again, that evidence is kind of old, and so it would be good to know more. Mm. But, you know, I don't there isn't anything in the data which really would suggest that either of the two choices that you make is better, that you two guys are making are, like, better or worse. And in particular, this thing of watching TV with your kid gets a lot of emphasis. And the idea that, like, if your kid's going to watch TV, like, and this is like an opportunity to engage with them, that's like a very different experience than sitting them in front of the TV. I will say, like, for my kids, like, on the weekends they get, like, you know, 45 minutes of TV, and I just leave them in front of it. I mean, I curate what they watch in the sense that they're not watching things on the internet. They're like have a set of things they can watch on their Kindles, but I don't engage with them on it most of the time. And I think part of that is, like, actually, like, that's like 45 minutes where, like, I'm cooking dinner and I, you know, like to relax and not parent for that 45 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, it's your break as well.
But
yeah.
There's a benefit. Right, there's a benefit to that as well, right?
Yeah, I think there is. I think we this is an example of something where we sort of fail to acknowledge, like, actually, like, I am a much better parent in the time before that and the time after that, because there's like this break in the day when yeah. I can, like, cook dinner and, like, you know, look at my email and, like, read a book or do whatever. And that's actually, like, then I am much more engaged at dinner sitting with the kids than I would be if I were tired or if it, you know, in every moment I had to be kind of entertaining them. And I think that that's, I think that's also important and something we don't talk about too much.
Absolutely. One area that is particularly we're jumping around subjects here because we could talk to you for 3 hours here quite easily about a number of different things. But one thing that I'm in the middle of right now is classic tantrums, absolutely enormous nuclear tantrums from a 2-year-old. And of course, again, another thing that, you know, going back to the idea of the broad spectrum of parental advice that you can get from good places, bad places, internet, leaflets, whatever it might be, books,
podcasts.
Yeah.
That's the best source.
Yeah, of course. But that, you know, the kind of spectrum of advice is enormous, and what you should do, how to deal with a tantrum. Do you try and engage and try and calm them down? Do you ignore it and not give weight to that negative behavior? Do you punish them? Do you not punish them? Do you cuddle them? Do you put them on the naughty step? All the, you know, many, many different things. And I am completely at a loss. I'm not going to pretend I have a clue because...
Emily, what should Rich do?
There's a book called 1-2-3 Magic by a guy named Thomas Phelan. Just buy it and do the things that he says in the book.
1-2-3 Magic. Sounds like we should get him on the podcast.
You should. I mean, I think, you know, that's a little bit of an extreme answer. Everybody's family is different, blah, blah, blah.
What does he say? I will say,
yeah. So this is like, so there's a suite of these. It's not the only one, but there's a suite of these kind of interventions, sort of positive parenting kind of interventions, which basically emphasize the idea of like a warnings and a timeout system. So, you know, one, like, this warning, this is a second warning, that's a timeout. I think his system is just, you just count like 1, 2, 3, and then there's a timeout if you get to 3. Mm-hmm. And the timeout is the number of minutes of the kid's age. And okay. And then you have a timeout, you put them in their room for the timeout. And then after, I think there's sort of like, the other thing is these programs emphasize a lot not discussing it. So like there's a, you're having a tantrum, or you're hitting your little sibling, or you're grabbing something from them, or you're doing something that's inappropriate. You just count 1, 2, time out if they don't stop doing it. And then, but then you don't afterwards say like, how did you feel about that? Like what, you know, why would you
keep doing
that? Because the thing is like, they're 2, they're 3, like they don't have access to that. And if you give them that language, then they're just going to make something, you know, particularly if you have like a very verbal, like my kids would just make up things about like, you know, how they are feeling in that moment. It's easy to be kind of sucked into that. But the thing is like, you can't take a toy. So actually it doesn't really matter how you feel about it. You just can't take the toy from
you. That feels really counterintuitive. I completely get the logic, but my thing wanting to be a good parent is I want to engage with him on it, and I want to talk to him and say, now, why did you do that? And all those types of things. But actually, when you put it like that, that does make some sense that you just move on from
it. Yeah, and I think it's really interesting what you say, and I think we sometimes forget this with kids, that they are just 3 years into their life and they haven't got those tools to understand or make sense of their behavior. So when you're trying to like put your kind of 40 years worth of you know, learned life experience and you know, I still lose my rag, as I'm sure Rich does.
Oh, wow, so I lose my rag a lot.
Can't expect them to be perfect human beings.
No, and I think this also, these things also emphasize that, like, because, like, sort of recognizing this, then you need to recognize in yourself, like, you can't get angry. You know, so your kid, like, the example I give in a book is, like, in the book is, like, you know, at some point I'm in, like, in some museum, and my kid, who was, like, 2 or 2.5, 3 at the time, just, like, decided he wanted to take his shirt off. And like he just like had to take his shirt off, and you know it was like kind of a fancy museum. He was like, you can't take your shirt off, you know. And so you're like, if your spouse did that, and they're just like, I'm gonna take my shirt off, you'd be like, what? Like, what is the matter with you? Like, why are you such an idiot? You know. But when your little kid wants to do that, like you can't get mad. Like they don't know, you know. You just have to say like, you can't do that. That behavior is not okay. Having a tantrum about that is not okay. But like, I can't be mad. Because, like, you don't know that you're not supposed to take your shirt off. And so really sort of trying to, like, rein it in and have the, like, warning and the timeout just be, like, very, like, that's a warning, that's a second warning, that's a timeout, without being, like, I can't believe you're, you know, without getting mad.
Which that's the bit I really struggle
very,
with.
Very, very hard, right?
That's the bit I really struggle with.
Oh, me too.
The stepping back. Yeah. And it's you saying that, again, rings a lot of bells with me, the idea that, because I do treat him as if he's 14 rather than 2.
Yeah. It's so easy because because probably when they're 14 they will be doing that.
Yeah. But and then I will be, you know, legitimately getting angry with him, but I get really angry with him and then I feel terrible about it afterwards. But it just I haven't learned those mechanisms
you're
yet
not
to
alone,
how to deal
Rich.
With it
not
yeah.
alone.
No, you're not alone. I mean, really, this book is really good. I really think that it was super helpful for us, and I've now like I've talked about it a bunch in the context of the crib sheet, and like, you know, yesterday I was at the pool with like the parent of, and I ran into the parent of some kid in my son's class, and he was like, you know, we bought that book because of your, because you know you talked about it, and like it's amazing, like it really is magic. You know, he was like, we've been doing it for like 2 days, and like we have
to get this guy on.
Gotta get this guy on. It seems like he'd be totally great.
Okay, excellent. No, I will look that up. Yeah, definitely. That's really helpful,
Emily. When you were researching the book and looking at the data, was there anything that you came across which surprised you based on your preconceptions of being from being a mother already?
So, I mean, I think there are pieces in the book that I found surprising. Not maybe not always so much the direction, but like the magnitude of them, or sort of how far things were from my sense. So, like breastfeeding is an example. So. I think I had a sense going into this that some of the benefits that people claim about breastfeeding may have been overstated. You know, you'll read these like women's magazines articles that are like, you know, breastfeeding is going to make your friendships better and, you know, your hair's shiny and like what, you know, like they're like, that can't be right. You know, my hair is really falling out. It can't be that it's going to get shiny. And so I think that I had some sense that would be true. And I think, but when I looked into the data, I think that was sort of more true than I expected. So, you know, there are some benefits to breastfeeding, particularly early in life, about better digestion and for the baby, and maybe some like long-term cancer reduction for the mom. So there are some benefits, but a lot of the things that are kind of thrown at women as a kind of like breastfeeding is the most important thing are things like your kid will be smarter later, or they'll be thinner, they'll have fewer diseases. And I think those things are basically not supported in the best data. And I think that I found the disconnect between really what can we say based on the evidence and what is the rhetoric pretty stark.
Interesting.
And did you adjust your own parenting style in any ways based on what you learnt?
Not small ways. So one thing is actually this 1-2-3 magic discipline stuff is something that I had not been doing until I did the research for the book. So that was like the sort of most direct thing. I think most of the other things I kind of did the research in the service of my parenting and then wrote the book. So there are places where this influenced how we were doing stuff, for sure. There are places where the data is sort of like tells you something very clear, like peanut allergies. So this is like sort of very in the weeds, but when my daughter was born, they told us not to give her any peanuts or any peanut butter or any peanut products until she was like a year or two, because it would make her allergic.
Who's they?
Yeah. the doctors, like the official recommendations.
Okay.
Around from like sort of medical, I've heard that. Medical, yeah, community.
I've read that somewhere. So
turns out that's the opposite of the truth. So it turns out that like, and now all of these recommendations have changed. And they actually had changed by the time my son was born. But it is now, the recommendation is that you give your kids peanuts like as soon as they are able to have solid food, that you give them peanut butter or some kind of peanut, expose them to peanuts, because that actually makes them much less likely to be allergic in the end.
That's the approach I've taken to all food with my kids.
Yes,
I've given
also
them
good.
The widest range of food from the earliest possible age. So they're both love shellfish. They both peanuts. You know, all vegetables. They would opt. I have to cook twice as much broccoli now when I cook for them, because that's all they'll eat. They'll just eat a plate of like soft cooked broccoli, which is like, I think, is incredible. You know, for a 1- and a 3-year-old.
Yeah, my son eats.
No,
a lot
I think
of salad.
That's pretty amazing.
My son eats a lot of salad. I find myself in these bizarre situations where I'm kind of getting really into it with my son, because you can't. And I'm saying to him, you can't just eat cucumber and tomatoes. You have to eat some of the sausage. And I think, hang on,
well, why not?
That's definitely back to front, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's definitely back to front. I'm sure that most parents find this the other way around. Like, Don't just eat the sausage. You have to eat the cucumber too.
Yeah. I just had a conversation.
No, but it's true that like it matters how much you expose. Like if you show them this stuff,
you're
just like, oh, this is the food that you eat. Like actually, those things are delicious.
Yeah, exactly. I said to my son the other day, "What's your favorite breakfast? Is it?" And I just went through. Is it porridge? Is it honey loops? Is it peanut butter on toast? Is it pancakes? Is it honey and yogurt? Or is it sausages and bacon? And he just looked at me and goes, sausage and bacon. And he's probably had sausage and bacon once. And it was an occasion when he and I went away for the night together, just a pair of us. And I cooked him and I sausages, bacon and eggs for breakfast the next morning. And it's to do with that memory of his. It's nothing to do with how much he likes the taste, I'm certain. Mm-hmm. It's because he associates it with that experience. Because he never asked for, when I say we're doing for breakfast, he never says, I want sausages and bacon. In fact, when my wife asked him, he said, I want ham and sausages. Because he knows he likes ham, but they're very interesting characters, young children. I find
it's interesting how much that your thing about the experience thing, that regardless of what you're asking them, it's the experience that they remember. Because just this morning, I was asking my son, I was taking him to nursery, and I was saying, so who are you going to play with at nursery today? Because I was trying to talk to him about his friends at nursery and everything. And whenever I ask a question, anything around that about his friends at nursery, there's a little pause, and he says, "Gabriel, push me." Gabriel's like another one of the boys at the nursery who he gets on with really well. But any time I ask him anything about his friends at nursery, he tells me this boy pushed. And it happened once. It happened ages ago. Yeah. And that's it. But that's his immediate memory. It's bizarre, isn't it?
We got that book. I'm sure you guys have it. The Tiger That Came to Tea, Judith Kerr, children's book. Quite kind of popular.
Yeah.
Sold millions of copies. When Jackson, my son, was very young, his grandmother was looking after him. And... she made, in fact, it wasn't that book, it's one of the Mog books that Judith Kerr has written as well. And when his grandmother was looking after him, she was making him his dinner, and she took some frozen peas out of the freezer, and the bag split, and frozen peas went everywhere. And there's a book in one of the Judith Kerr books where the mum's making some dinner and a cat surprises her and peas go all over the floor, and every time Jackson looks at that book, he's like, grandma did that.
But she loves that.
Yeah, poor grandma.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's it.
Emily, I know we're sort of coming towards the end of our time here. I guess maybe this is a very obvious final question, but from your, you know, from all the research you've done, you've written this very extensive study in this book, Is there one bit of advice, one thing, one kind of lesson you would like to, you know, give to parents
apart
who are listening or reading?
Apart from 1, 2, 3 magic.
Apart from 1, 2, 3 magic, which we is definitely on. I'm on Amazon already ordering it. but is there sort of one thing from all the research, all the work you did, that you think is kind of the most single valuable bit of advice you could give?
Either mums and dads do this or mums and dads don't do this. Mm.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think that, like, the in some ways, the point of the book, much more so than, like, here's something to do, here's something not to do, is that, like, you have, like, these choices are going to be very parent family specific, and that making the right choice for your family is going to involve looking at the data and then thinking about what works for your family. So people sometimes say, like, what's the one thing I can do? And it's sort of like, I don't know, like, you know, give them peanuts when they're 4 months. But, like, on these other things, there isn't one thing. Like, you know, you, like, making these choices in a way that makes you a confident and happy parent, maybe that's the one thing. But that's not, like, one choice. It's not that one choice is like, the right choice.
Maybe it's that's mixed. Yeah. Maybe that's the point. There is no magic answer, right? Maybe that's the point.
Yeah, and it's yeah. And you know, then you have and you gotta like figure out what works, because if you're sort of super stressed out and unhappy, like that's not gonna be good for your family.
But our kids are gonna be all right, aren't they? Just simply because we
great.
Are we
great.
Are worried and concerned
exactly.
about
things.
No, I
almost always tell people this. People are like, you know, people ask me these questions, like, what's the right preschool philosophy? What's I'm like, once you're worried about that, like, it's fine. You know, any preschool philosophy is fine. Like, you know, you're like over the hill because you're thinking about what's the right preschool philosophy. Like, your kid's gonna be okay.
Yeah,
they're gonna be.
Well,
good.
There you go. That sounds like a nice way to bring it to
on,
a
yeah.
close. Emily, we've really enjoyed talking to you, and certainly thanks for that book tip.
Yeah, joy.
Do you know what your next book's going to be?
I don't. I might do something about older kids, but I'm trying to figure out quite the right way in.
Okay, well maybe we'll catch up with you in a while's time when our kids are in the next stage of development.
Exactly. And in the meantime, exactly. everybody should go out and buy/read/both Crib Sheet by Emily Oster. It's a great read, very very handy, very very helpful indeed.
Cheers, Emily.
Thank you. Thanks, cheers.
Thanks, Emily. Bye.